Oh, beloved saints. On the race here. Okay. We've gotten it in the class discussion. We're just beginning on the Luke chapter 1, verse 5, on the beginning of John the Baptist. Before we do that, though, I want to give you some handouts. And if I could happily have some helpers, that'd be wonderful. Take one at a time. Okay, first file is file number one. Now, file number one is entitled The Hellenistic Influence on Palestine. And Hellenism refers to Grecian influence. Hellenism speaks of Grecian influence. And this file is dealing with the Grecian influence on Palestine. Now, I want you to read it. You will be tested on the information in it. And so be sure to read file number one. The information will be tested on in the first test in the class, which will be who knows when. I'll let you know. Okay, so don't just forget about it. Put that down somewhere and go ahead and go through the information. Underline the information that's important in it. Okay, file number two. File number two is a blank map of Palestine. It's a blank map. And it's going to be your exercise. It's sort of an assignment preparing you for a test next week. And the test, or the assignment, actually, it's not going to be turned in, is known from file number three. So now, there's three files heading your way. One, two, and now number three. By the way, students, everybody, stop. Melissa. What's your name? Gilbert. Okay, let me show you how to pass out files. I can see you need an instruction. Everybody's going to be doing a lot of it, especially those that sit up front. What you do is you take your sheet of paper, you take your pile of paper, especially easy when you only got one sheet, probably like this. Hold it on one end, let it drop. And then grab the end that's dropped. Grab it. And then fold out like that. Fold out straight. Okay, hold the other end, let the same end drop. And then grab it again. And then let loose with your right hand and fold it up. You keep going back and forth and back and forth. And you can pretty soon, you can get these babies out. You've got a quarter inch between each sheet. And what you basically want to do is just get a little bit of breath, a little bit of air between each sheet. Okay? So like this. Then you don't even have to look. Just look down the aisle, see the six. That's six. Next aisle, you go five. All of this is trying to take them out. It doesn't work. It goes slow. It goes too slow. So, set them out like that. So hold on with your right hand like this. Bend them out like that. No. Hold that tight. Who doesn't know how to do this? Does everybody know how to do this? You grab one side and then bend it, see? And grab that other side and set it straight. And grab the opposite side and bend it. Grab that side and set it straight. And just keep doing that until that thing just comes right up. Oh, that's an extra. That's just, okay, thanks. Okay, now, file number three gives you the assignment. Now, you're not going to turn this assignment in. What you're going to do is you're going to look on file number three and you're going to locate on your map all of that information. It's self-explanatory. It tells you what to do at the top of the page. As soon as you all get file number three, I'll tell you what to fill in there at the top. Okay, does everybody have file number three? Need one more file number three? Or is there an extra? There you go. That's the file number two. Okay, at the top of file number three, thanks. It says, be able to name and locate the following places on a blank map of Palestine. The test is scheduled for a, and then write in, Thursday. That's next week. Thursday, the 17th day of September. Okay? Thursday, the 17th day of September. Okay, got it? Now, what you do is you take all that information that you've got on file number three, and you write it out. You locate it, find it on file number two. That's that sheet, file number two. Now, if you want to do it more than once, or if you want to practice test at home, then take a carbon copy of your file number two first before you start writing on it, so that you got a blank copy. And then fill in one of them, and then you can take a mock test on your other one by just looking at file number three, which gives you all the places. You don't have to memorize everything on file number three. You just have to know where to locate it. That's all. Now, what I'm going to do on the 17th is I'm going to give you another blank map. That's all I'm going to do is give you a blank map. Only this one will be numbered. And there will be numbers of all the places. Hi, Magnus. Is that Magnus? I thought, good to see you again. Good to see you again. And what I want you to do, there will be numbers on it corresponding to all of these places on file number three. That's all it will be. Now, the reason for the test is obvious. I'm talking about places all the time. And if you don't know where they are, you know, it's a waste of time. So you need to know when I mention Capernaum, you need to know where it's at. And Bethsaida and all the rest, the mountains and so forth. In fact, I'll probably mention some of them today. And it'll be good if you know them. So, second note to the wise. Don't wait until the night before to do your assignment. Now remember, you don't have to turn in this assignment. All this assignment is for you so that you can be prepared for the test. Okay? You don't wait until that time. Do it tonight. It'll only take you a few minutes. Do it tonight. Get a Bible atlas, a Bible geography, a Bible dictionary, your own study Bible. They'll have maps in it. A good study Bible has got maps of Palestine at the time of Christ in them. Look up the places, get them on your map, and then just 5 minutes a day during the week. And that's the way to study for tests. It really is. Just a little bit of time, more often, is much better than a whole bunch of time, big cram the night before, because you forget it the day after. And it's really cheating you from what you can get out of Bible college. It really is. So a little bit each day is much better. So I'd like you to do that. The test will be next Thursday. Yes. Yes. You don't have to memorize them. I'm going to write on the board everything that you have on file three so that you don't have to know it. You'll have it on the board and be able to place it. Because that's what basically happens in class. I'll say Mount Gerizim. You just have to know where to put it. See, you don't have to have it memorized. You just have to know where to put it. So I'll give you that information on the board when you take the test. Question? Was there another question? Yeah.
What about this file one? Is that going to be on...
No, no. That will be on another test. That will be on the first major test, dealing with the introductory material, so forth. That will be a little while. Okay, now, before I go any further, there are a couple that I want to clarify. Look at file number two. That's the blank map. Now, there's one little change I want to make. The Sea of Galilee is this sea, right straight across from Mount Carmel. It's the sea up in the northern central part of the map, the Sea of Galilee. Most of you are probably familiar with that. It looks kind of like this. Well, somewhat like that. That wasn't too good. But anyway, you know, it's kind of like that. Whatever. And then you've got your Jordan River going down. Now, at the top of it, I've got the waters of Merom here, and it goes up. This is the waters of Merom, by the way. Above the Sea of Galilee, that's what I call the waters of Merom. There's question as to whether it was ever a lake. It may have just been a marshy area. Some say that the waters of Merom is this little rivulet coming into the Sea of Galilee. There's different thoughts on where the waters of Merom is. For our interest, the waters of Merom is that little lake-looking area above the Sea of Galilee.
So anyway, on the Sea of Galilee, the northern part, you've got the river coming into it, the main one, and then a little rivulet just to the west of it. Now, just right next and west of that rivulet is a large dot. Okay? That is Capernaum. That is Capernaum. And that's been fairly well substantiated by archaeological findings. Now, just west of that is a smaller dot. That used to be Bethsaida. But I want to erase it. So I want you to cross that out or whatever, or just forget about it, and remove that dot and put it over on the other side or the east side of the main river coming into the Sea of Galilee. Put it on the east side of that main river coming into the Sea of Galilee and just right on the, basically on the shores of the Sea of Galilee. So I want you to add a dot just on the northeast tip of the Sea of Galilee, and that's Bethsaida. Now, there's always been a question. In fact, probably on some of the maps you look at, it'll say Bethsaida question mark. And sometimes it'll be over here where I originally had it, and sometimes it'll be over here where I'm now putting it. Where I'm now putting it by further findings is much better substantiated than where it used to be. The more the modern maps will have it over to the right, the northeast tip of the Sea of Galilee. Okay? So that's what I want to change it to. Because otherwise, depending on which map you look at, you may never find what this little other dot is to the west of Capernaum. So I want you to erase that one and put it over here on the northeast tip, and that's Bethsaida. Okay? So that'll clarify that. Now, that's not the dot that's down on the east side of the Sea of Galilee. That's a different city. That's a different city. I'm not even going to tell you what it is because I can't remember right now. I think it's Gadara. Anyway. So that's a different dot. So you've got, now, your map should be changed to read two dots on the east side there. Okay. See, Don, I'm looking for some... I'll get to you soon, just a second. All right. There's also one other point I want to make. The Dead Sea is down on the southern tip of the Jordan River. On the northeast tip of the Dead Sea, you see another town. You see it there? Right up there? That is Bethabara. Now, there's conflicting views as far as where Bethabara was. Bethabara was considered to be the place where John the Baptist was put in prison by Herod. Bethabara was a tremendous stronghold. My research has shown that, more recent research, as far as I can tell, that Bethabara is there. And so I just want to let you know that. Now, some will have Bethabara up in the area of Decapolis. I'm trying to remember exactly where. There's a river called the Yarmouk, just south of the Sea of Galilee, and it comes from the east coming into the Jordan River, heading west into the Jordan River. I believe that Bethabara is sometimes thought to be just below that, either on the east or the west of the Jordan River, like, in other words, down here or over here. And but I am choosing this spot down here by the Dead Sea. So, if you come into any discrepancy, just let it be known that I am saying Bethabara is down here. Okay? Some of those you just can't know. We'll do the best we can. All right, those are the only discrepancies that I wanted to point out to you on file number two. So your test will be next Thursday. It'll be the same blank map, only everything will be numbered. And so you have to put next to the number what it is. City, river, mountain, or whatever. Okay? Okay, another file, file number six. Somebody who's willing to try. Pass this one out. No takers? Come on. Here you go, brother. Try again. Just grab it here and just go like that. There you go. And just grab it. There you go. All right, file number six. Do you have a question?
I think there might be a type on file number one. It should be file load down at the end of rather than fill.
Now, on file number one? Jesus' contemporary, yeah, that definitely was Philo.
Okay.
Phil. Okay, that's Philo. Thank you. File number one, down at the bottom of the page, the last paragraph on the front. It says, a vast number of Jews had dispersed into Gentile lands from Babylonia to Rome and beyond in the time of Phil. It should be Philo. P-H-I-L-O. Yes. Same one, huh? First time I found it. Let you know how often I've read it. Either that or I glanced through it. I've glanced through it a few times, so I don't know why I've never seen it. Okay, very good. Philo. You'd have a hard time looking through history to find Phil. All right, I'm just handing out to you. Well, the brother's already got a handout. Did it work good? It must have just worked fast. See how that works? Okay. File number six. Now, file number six is a comparison of the four Gospels. I told you I'd be giving that to you. This is information you will not be tested on. It's for your own interest. But I'd like you just to look through it. Just in comparing the four Gospels. That's basically what it is. Just comparing the four Gospels. Okay. Now I have one more file I want to hand out this morning. File number seven. This is a map, a mock-up, thanks. A mock-up of Herod's temple at the time of Jesus. And this map, we're just going to look at a few things, a few characteristics on it. Now, while he's passing that out, I want to make known to you that there is another map that you may want to buy. I'd encourage you to buy it. It's available in the bookstore, and the title of it is Schick's Model of Herod's Temple in Jerusalem. And it's on stiff paper and it's plastic coated, so it'll last. It's real punched. And it gives you backed off a little bit and it gives you a model picture here of Herod's temple. Now, every model of Herod's temple that you'll see is a little bit different from the last one. And what they're doing is they've got sketchy information on what it was like. And many times, the scholars, and I've seen this again and again, they basically draw on the same information. But they'll come up with different models, and that's because it's sketchy. So each one's a little bit different. So you've got, if you buy Schick's model, you've got this, plus the model that you have there in your photograph. Now, I am not sure where this picture exactly came from. Thanks, brother. Appreciate your help. So I can't send you to the original source. 440 square foot scale model, and I'm not sure whose it is. Now you'll notice several features on this model. First of all, you've got at the top right, you've got two main prominent features. The one to the left is the temple proper itself that houses the holy place and the Holy of Holies. And the high point there was called the pinnacle of the temple. And there's discussion as to whether the pinnacle of the temple that Jesus left off, or was tempted to leap off of was that point right there. Or some say it may have been on the eastern part of the temple that overlooked the Kidron Valley. My opinion is that it was right here. So that high point there is the pinnacle of the temple. It was overlaid with gold. Gold and silver was all throughout this temple area. Much of it, and brass was real common. Herod was trying to outdo Solomon. And Solomon, of course, during his days, gold was as common as silver. And silver was as common as brass, and brass was as common as stones in the street. And so Herod was trying to outdo Solomon, and he made it as lavish as he could. The Jews were very rich people. They were very productive in all that they did. And so there was a lot of money gained by Herod the Great in his rulership over Rome. We'll be talking about Herod the Great later. But he is the one that built this temple. By the time of Christ, if you read in John chapter 2 and verse, I think it is 20-21, after Jesus said, destroy this temple, and they said, well, we've 46 years in building this temple, and you're going to destroy it in 3 days and raise it up? You know? Raise it up in 3 days, I mean. It took 46 years, and so it started about it started about 20 B.C. is when the temple was began to be built by Herod the Great. About 20 B.C. Now, that prominent feature, therefore, the pinnacle, very tall. It was approximately, if I recall now, I don't have it written down here, approximately 100 feet tall. The opening of the door was over 30 feet, I believe, or about 30 feet itself. The opening into the holy place, and there was doors there, and then there was the curtain, and then there was the heavy curtain that led into the Holy of Holies. On the side of the temple there, you can see colonnades, and there were three stories of chambers for the priests to live during their ministry when they were there in Jerusalem. And those chambers went all the way around the temple. And it's elevated. And standing right in front there is probably the high priest. He's got his arms raised, it looks like, in this model. And then there's priests on either side of him. And then there's the steps that lead down. And then they split and they go to either side, leading down to the main floor. And then right in front of that, right in front of those steps, as they split and go to the side, there is the huge sacrificial altar. And the sacrificial altar has steps leading up to it from the left. Can you see those? It's a huge sacrificial altar right in front of the temple proper, and there's steps leading up from the left. And that thing was about 30 feet tall. That's where they offered the sacrifices. And there was a lamb twice a day, once in the morning, once at night, every day. Plus, and then on the Sabbath day and so forth. And probably, I'm thinking what he has pictured here, these sort of round, barrel-like, right in front of the sacrificial altar in a semicircle to the right of it. And then if you look, it's also to the left of it, although it's covered by this high pinnacle leading into the court of the priests. I think those are the lavers that Herod had built. And here it has depicted several of them. And those, I'm not sure what material they were made out of, but that's where the water was held and the priests would wash themselves in the lavers. And this is where the priests would come, and just before it was the court of the men of Israel. Now, we lead down, coming towards us, you'll see another pinnacle, high pinnacle, and then circular steps, 15 of them to be exact. 15 circular steps leading into a larger courtyard. That's, of course, again, surrounded by a heavy colonnade. Well, this courtyard here is called the Court of the Women of Israel, because that's all the further the Court of the Women of Israel could go. And in it was also the treasure chests, and there were 13 of them. And those treasure chests held the various types of offerings that people would make. Each treasure chest had a specific assignment of what was to be put into it. You know, for what purpose, I mean. And this is where Jesus often taught, was here in this open place, because then all the men and women of Israel could come in here. And those 15 steps, of course, the men could step up those and then lead into the court of the men of Israel. That was right in front of the brazen altar. But then the priests could only go up to the altar and then up to the temple itself. Now, this other prominent feature to the right top, this high cylindrical tower, that was the castle of Antonia. The castle of Antonia, built by Herod again. I think it was named after one of his lovers. I'm not positive of that. Yes? This high prominent cylindrical feature on the top right is the castle of Antonia. It's actually outside the temple, but it has a buried underground tunnel leading from it into the court of the men of Israel area of the temple. And that tunnel gave access for Herod to come in and to worship with the Jews. And the reason why he had that tunnel is out of fear of his life. Because he built this castle after his life had been threatened and he almost lost it. He was always under threat. I mean, the Jews are always trying to kill him. And we'll talk about him more later, as I mentioned. So he built this castle here so that he could climb to the top. The soldiers could climb to the top, look down into the temple area, and see what those crazy Jews were doing. And so after he built this, as the Jews would be worshiping, and often they would worship, either they'd worship with their hands upraised, facing the temple, or at times they'd even bow their face to the ground. But whenever they opened their eyes and looked up, guess who was looking at them? Herod or some crazy Roman soldier. And that thing was a constant, thorn in the side at Castle of Antonia. It, of course, was a real strong, solid structure and was one of the last places to be taken in 70 A.D., the temple being the very last. Now, another feature around the temple is this wall. It sort of forms a border in your picture there. It's a low wall, and it has openings in it. And in front of those openings are these stone pillars. And written on these stone pillars in several languages was a threat to any Gentiles that if they ever went beyond that low wall, they would be killed. And it separated the Jews from the Gentiles. And this area outside of it here, surrounding the temple, was called the Court of the Gentiles. And the Gentiles could come that far as that low wall, and they could go no further. They go up to that wall, but no further. So the Gentiles could come in there. The Jews could enter inside, men, women, and children, and then only the men could go past the court of the women of Israel into this other area in front of the altar. Okay? The temple opening faces the east, the sun rising. It represents it's facing the coming of Jesus Christ. Because Jesus Christ is the fulfillment of this entire temple. And this temple is not exactly the pattern that God gave. God gave two patterns. One to Moses, and that was the tabernacle. The second pattern he gave to David. God gave to David the pattern and the materials. Solomon built it. So the second pattern God gave to David. And Zerubbabel built a temple that was quite a bit different, but it was after his own pattern. And it was somewhat trying to follow Solomon's, although it was a much bigger temple and not near as lavish. Herod, of course, he did not have God's pattern either. There's only three patterns that God gave. One of them hasn't been built yet, and that's Ezekiel's. And that's, we're waiting for the millennium for that. That pattern will be built in the millennium. Okay, so this faces east, so north is to your right, and you're looking west, basically, as this is being viewed. The temple was quite an area, quite a large area. It is said that on the day of Passover, that is on the first day when they offered up the lambs, that there was about 250,000 lambs, according to Josephus, that were offered on that day. And each lamb would represent normally about 10 or more Jews. So it is estimated that upwards to 3 million Jews would actually be there at the time of the Passover. Now, this area is, it's big, but, you hardly wonder how many of that could get in there. Well, I'll tell you what they did. On the Passover, they had to go through three shifts. So there'd be approximately 80,000 men that would come through with their lamb on each shift. And they would have it very orderly, and the priests, of course, would be ruling it. And the men would come in, kill their lamb, and there'd be hooks all the way around the extremity of this place. They'd put their lamb up on the hook, gut it, skin it, and whatever they did to it. They'd spill the blood into a bowl, and the bowls would be passed to the priests. And they'd splash them into bigger bowls, and then they'd hand these all the way up to the altar. And so the bowls of blood would be sacrificed, as it were, on the altar. Because that's what you were to do on the Passover. At the Passover sacrifice. And there was so much blood, they actually had piping going from the altar of sacrifice down out of the temple into the brook Kidron. And the Kidron River is, well, we're standing over the top of it. It was east, you see, of the temple. And to just give you a quick, you've probably seen pictures of Jerusalem and the outlay of the temple in it. But the basic city was built on a kind of a hill area like this. The Kidron River went through here. This is the Tyrrhenian Valley, actually, and this area was the Valley of Hinnom.
We get the word Gehenna from it.
And the temple, now I'm not exactly right on here, but the temple was situated about here. And so it was right next to the edge of the Kidron Valley. And it was real steep right here too. And as you'd approach the temple from all sides, it looked upward from where you were. It wasn't as high if you approached from this side over here. But everywhere else you came from, it was all up. Because there's a valley here, a deep valley here. This is the Mount of Olives over here. Here's where the temple area was. It was the last place to be taken by the Romans when they destroyed Jerusalem. And the population was mainly in this area. There was also population down here. The city has expanded some today. But they would run these people through here, 80,000 at a time, offering their lands, taking that blood, sacrificing it, and piping going down in here to several pools. What they did with the pools of blood is they let the sun dry it out and they sell it for fertilizer. So the priests make a little bit of money there. Priests made a lot of money on a lot of things. And the whole nation, that's why the Sadducees were so rich, because they were the priestly class, or they at least the priestly class, many of them were part of the Sadducees, I should put it that way. Yes. The first Passover? What do you mean? You mean time of Jesus? Yeah. Like I said, it'd be somewhere up to 3 million. That's estimated. That's estimated. The Passover was the heaviest attended feast. I'm not sure of the population. I tried to find it and I could never find it, what they estimated the population of Palestine to be at that time. My guess was somewhere around 3 to 4 million. And the reason why, now the whole nation did not just come to Jerusalem for the Passover. The reason why I know that is because there were Jews from all over the world that came. And so there would be those that would stay home. And it's probably really crowded. And, you know, they weren't literalistically following all the laws of God at the time. But, so it would be pretty loaded. And as I mentioned, at 70 AD, when Jerusalem was destroyed, it's estimated 1 million Jews died in that battle. And all of the Jews didn't die. So there may have been 1.5 million, 2 million Jews that were in the city. I don't know how many. It was a jam-packed, for sure. Okay. So that gives you just kind of a feel for the area. And you may want to buy the southern map. I think it's only 50 cents or a dollar, something like that. Well, one more point. Solomon's Porch. You've heard of Solomon's Porch? Solomon's Porch would be right about underneath where you're standing. It's the porch that was to the east of the temple overlooking the Kidron Valley. That's where Solomon's Porch was. And it was a long colonnade. Let me show you in this mock-up here. Here in Schick's model, here's the temple proper. It's facing east. Here's the court of the men of Israel, the court of the women of Israel. Here he's got it, the walls and everything is much heavier and thicker than what we see in this mock-up here in general. Solomon's Porch was the main colonnade on the east side of the temple. So that would be right there, evidently. Right there. That's what I'd guess at this point. And, actually, he's got it right here, yes. Yeah, Solomon's Porch is that main one right here. He's got on the back side, he's got a diagram of it. Here he's got the court of the Gentiles. Here's this wall that separated the Jews from the Gentiles. And here's the basic temple area with the court of the women of Israel, court of the men of Israel. And then here's where the priests were, the court of the priests, where the altar was. And here's that high porch with the pinnacle on it, the holy place, and then the Holy of Holies. And around the temple were all the places where the priests lived during their time of ministry. This is called the Royal Porch. This is called Solomon's Porch. And here's the Fortress of Antonia as far as the major structure. The pinnacle, or the tower, or the castle of Antonia, I'm not sure if that is in this picture or not. As I say, there's different questions as to where that was. It may have been outside here, or maybe it was right in the fortress here. Maybe that's it there. I don't know. Not sure. Okay. You see, how many of you have seen pictures of the Wailing Wall? You notice how that's down low
It's dug down. You notice that? How to get down to the Wailing Wall, you have to go down. Because the basic street level is above that. And that's because of all the wars that Jerusalem has been under and all the destruction. That if you're to go down to original streets at the time of Christ, you've got to go 30 feet down. You've got to go 30 feet down. If you're familiar with archaeology, you'll find that when they study cities, almost always, especially if it's been cities that are still there today, if they're going to find original cities, they've got to dig down. Because there's a constant sediment coming, and the wars and the destruction, and they rebuild over it, and sometimes floods and other things. You have to dig down to get to it. And that's the way they had to do to Jerusalem. So if you hear somebody tell, you know, if you're to go over there and they're to say, this is the street that Jesus walked, it probably is not. It's probably 30 feet down. You know, and there may be some original streets in the city. I've read that they say that there are. But, for instance, you know, you look at the Wailing Wall, you find out they had to dig way down in order to find that wall. That was a portion of Herod's temple, supposedly. A portion of Herod's temple. And I even read in one that they said they believe that there even are a couple of the blocks, original foundation stones from Solomon's temple, that are still there somewhere, you know. And whether that's true or not, I don't know. I mean, there's been so much destruction. The blocks are so huge, and the ones at Herod's temple were so huge that I can imagine some of them are probably still there, particularly the foundation ones. But you have to dig down to get to it. And some of the Wailing Wall was not of Herod's temple. That's right towards the bottom. Most of it that you see of the Wailing Wall is after the time of Herod. It's not near as elaborate, and the blocks are not near as huge. The temple of Herod was one of the wonders of the world at that time. And Titus wanted to save it, who was the general under Vespasian, I believe, that his soldiers finally destroyed it. There's different conflicting histories on it, but that's probably the case. He probably wanted to save it because it was such a gorgeous edifice. But by the time they got to wanting to exterminate the Jews, they didn't care what else went with it. The temple was destroyed. Okay, any questions? Yes. Yes.
So is it true that Herod's temple and Solomon's temple are not caverns of Jesus given by God?
No, Solomon's was. Herod's wasn't. That we know of. Herod obviously would have read what was given by Moses, by David. And
the temple
is also. Oh, yes. Yeah. See, God gave it to David. And David had the blueprints. And he stored up the material, but God would not let him build it. And so he gave it to his son Solomon, and Solomon built it. So Solomon's temple was also a pattern of God. And it's really, the study of the temples is a marvelous study. A lot of revelation involved. Tabernacles class is one of the more exciting classes to me, because everything in it, it points out Jesus Christ and his relationship to us and ours to him. So that's what I was saying. Zerubbabel's temple, we don't have we don't have recorded that he received any explicit direction from God as far as, you know, size and everything else. And Herod, we don't on that either. Quite sure that he didn't. He undoubtedly read about Solomon's temple, got what information he could, tried to outdo it. Yes. Yeah. Did Zerubbabel what? No. Zerubbabel was at the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. And he was one of the rulers in Jerusalem. And there was the restoration. It was under Zerubbabel. They called it Zerubbabel's temple because he was the leader at that time, the head of the people. But Nehemiah in particular worked with him. And they restored Jerusalem and then rebuilt the temple. And it was a lot different in size and so forth. Yes. No, they really don't. They've got synagogues. But right there where the temple used to be is the Mosque of Omar. It's a Muslim mosque. And so they go in there to honor Muhammad and so forth. It's a dome. It's a bronze dome. If you've ever seen a picture of it, it's a real striking feature in the city. And it's considered to be built right over the place where Solomon's temple was. And it is in the same place as, the temple of Herod was.
And there is in it, the basic feature, if you look inside of it, is a huge rock, solid rock. They say that's what the temple is built on. And so they're saying that really, basically, they're saying it belongs to us. And that Abraham and Muhammad and so forth, they're the great kings. And Jesus Christ, I mean, they give honor to Jesus as a great prophet. And then, of course, Muhammad is a chief prophet. And this prophecy in Scripture speaks of the temple that the Antichrist is going to go into and call himself God. And because of the term used, the inner sanctuary, and because of the whole concept and idea, it is assumed that the temple will be rebuilt. And also, when you look at other prophecies in the Old Testament, now that prophecy is in 2 Thessalonians 2. You look at prophecies in the Old Testament concerning the priests weeping between the porch and the altar and so forth, it is probable that a temple is rebuilt. Now, how long it takes? It may not take that long to rebuild a temple. And it could very possibly, there's two revealings of the Antichrist. The first revealing, he does not go into the temple and call himself God. The second revealing, he does. The first revealing will happen before the rapture. The second revealing happens after the rapture. It's possible that during that time the temple is rebuilt. It's possible that during that time the temple is rebuilt. But we don't exactly know. But we do know this, that by the time of Armageddon, there's evidently a temple there that the Jews and the priests are using at that time. So, and then we have the pattern of Ezekiel's temple that will evidently be built in the millennium. But the destruction to Jerusalem after the Battle of Armageddon, in that whole time period, actually in one sense, the Battle of Armageddon, we use it to include the whole war against Israel. But that's basically the Valley of Megiddo. Armageddon is the Valley of Megiddo, and the war that begins up there, but it spreads southward and comes down to Jerusalem, and the city is taken, it says. And the houses rifled, the women ravished, and destruction to the whole city. Then all that's left is one third of the city. In other words, the people. And that's when Jesus comes down. Mount of Olives splits in half, and they run through that as a way of escape. And they cried out between the porch and the altar, you know, where the men of Israel could come. So they cried out to God and for salvation, and the Lord saves them. And then they look unto him whom they have pierced. And they acknowledge him, and he saves them. So it took quite a bit to get them to hear the voice of God. But the point being is that there's a temple, so but there isn't one now. I haven't heard any substantiation of it, I read a while back that there were materials being gathered by the Jewish government to begin the building of a temple, and that they had plans. Now, they had plans, and they took that land stretching between them and Egypt. The Suez, area of Suez, whatever. And but now it's had to be given back, and there's had to be repopulation and relocation and all kinds of stuff that have taken on since that time, because the national mentality did not want them to have that. And they were trying to get Abraham's promise by themselves. And There's evidently going to be a restoration of them before the end. And so there's undoubtedly more wars that are going to take place. The land is going to be like the Garden of Eden, it says, before the northern armies. And so there's evidently much more restoration and other things that are going to happen over there in the land of Palestine. And Jews are returning to the land. Didn't I tell you that story about that person I heard of from Colorado? And this has been around the world, actually. Different ones coming back to the land. They're still holding their identity. But regardless, somehow, in some time. But I wouldn't just look at that as a sign of, well, this is, you know. Because you could be a lot closer to the end before the temple be built than we realize. Because it may not take that long. I mean, if you got everything all together in 1 year, you could do a lot of building. And so, I mean, it could be right up to the time of, you know, I mean, it could be right up to the time of the rapture before they even start rebuilding the temple. So I wouldn't wait to start getting ready for Jesus to come back when you see the temple starting to be rebuilt. Okay. All right. Luke chapter 1, verse 5. The beginning of John the Baptist. There was in the days of Herod, the king of Judea, a certain priest named Zacharias of the course of Abiah, and his wife was of the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. We won't be talking about Herod now. Herod the Great, he was called. We'll talk about him later. And there was a man, a certain priest named Zacharias. Zacharias means he who remembers Yah. He remembers Yahweh. He remembers the Lord. He was a common priest. He was not one of the chief priests or a high priest. Interesting, the term that they used was idiot priest. It doesn't mean quite as bad as we take it to mean, but it meant more of a common sort of lowly priest. According to Edersheim, he lived south of Jerusalem. We'll see it, that at his birth, that at the birth of John, that the noise of it went abroad through the hill country south of Jerusalem. And so undoubtedly that's where he lived. Many feel that it was probably Hebron, which was a main priestly city, although it doesn't have to be. But Hebron was the main priestly city south of Jerusalem. And he was of the course of Abiah. Now, Abiah means a worshiper of Yahweh, which he certainly was. What was a course? Well, King David divided the priesthood into 24 courses. Abiah was the eighth of those 24. And these courses were groups of priests that would each rotate every week throughout the year in their ministry at the temple. So that instead of all the priests ministering all the time at the temple, only 1/24th of the priests would minister 1 week at a time. That way, you would minister twice a year for a week, plus all the priests would come at the feasts. So during the time of the feasts, all the priests came, but all the rest of the time during the year, each course would minister once a week. Josephus says that there were approximately 20,000 priests at his time. And normally, now if you divide that in 24, there'd be, say, 900 priests per course. And it was estimated that about a third of the priests would usually come of each course. So that means about 300 priests would come each week. And then they'd split up the days. So out of the 6 days of the week, 50 would minister each day. And then on the Sabbath day, all 300 would minister. So that's basically how it would go about. Giving you a taste of what the Talmud says, the Talmud said that the smallest course had 85,000 priests, which is ridiculous. Because that, if it was an average, then, of 100,000 priests per course, that 24 courses would be 2.5 million priests. There weren't that many priests. There weren't that many. Now, his wife was of the daughters of Aaron, meaning that she was the daughter of a priest. Therefore, any child that they had would have double honor. Because he would come from a priest as a father, and also he'd come from a mother whose father was a priest. So there was priesthood on both sides for John. So he was of double honor. Elizabeth means dedicated to God. Or God is her oath, as some say it. Verse 6. And they were both righteous before God, walking in all the commandments and ordinances of the Lord blameless. The commandments normally points to the moral laws. The ordinances more commonly points to the ceremonial laws. That means they not only followed the moral laws, loving your neighbor and all of that, the Ten Commandments, but they also followed the ceremonial laws and keeping of the feasts and the sacrifices and so forth. Verse 7. And they had no child because that Elizabeth was barren and they both were now well stricken in years. Now whenever you find a barren woman in the scripture like this, you know you're looking towards a miracle child. Because here's one that is involved with the coming of the Messiah. And so the child is going to be a child of promise. It's going to be a miracle of God. And this is often what God has done in history. Is that when he wants to do something for man to behold, he takes man to his extremity. So that man, it's obvious that man is sterile in himself. Man has no strength in himself. Man has no ability in himself, and God does a miracle. Think about the other barren women in the scripture. Sarah, the wife of Abraham. Who was born? Isaac. Then who did Isaac marry? Isaac married Rebekah. Rebekah was also barren. and could have no child. When she finally gave birth, she gave birth to Jacob. No. All right, let's see. Yeah, Isaac married Rebekah, who gave birth to Jacob. And Jacob, when he married Leah and Rachel. Guess who was barren? Rachel. That was his first love. And when Rachel finally had a child, who did she have? Joseph. And all of those, there we have the patriarchs and their wives. We're all barren. And those are, and God says, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And all three of their wives are barren. And it was a reproach to have a barren wife. But man's extremity is God's opportunity. So God brings man down to his nothing so that God be everything. Notice that in your own life, maybe, a little bit? And we have some other examples, too. Hannah was barren and besought God for a child. And who did she have? Samuel. And Samuel was the first judge, that great judge of Israel and prophet. And he even acted as king. And of course, he's the one that anointed Saul and also anointed David. And then Manoah's wife, she was barren, cried out for a child. Who did she have? Samson. And Samson was one of the judges and deliverers of Israel. And so now we have Elizabeth. Now, every one of these children that were born of a barren woman were all forerunners of Christ. They all pointed to Christ. And it denoted, therefore, a miracle child, a promised child, representing Christ, pointing to Christ, and turning the weakness of man into the strength of God. Okay, go ahead. Let you go. A lot of perspectives for a living in the Gospels, to be sure.